by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest my dab in the middle of it. Rest my dab in the middle. We are. Rest my dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to be covering the D-Day landings this hour, the second hour. And also we're going to be playing right at the end the President Trump's speech, which almost everyone has applauded as being a very fine, a very great speech. But we're going to be talking this first half of this second hour about D-Day and what was that all about. And there was great deception involved also, but it involved mobilizing a tremendous army to get across the English Channel that separated England from mainland France, from Europe. And so it was not an easy chore to do, and the Germans were well fortified along the French coast. Calais is where they anticipated, or Sherborne, they anticipated our landing would be, an invasion would be. And there was great deception that was employed to do that. Normandy, the coast of Normandy, was divided into five sectors. You'll find these on a little map on thesecrettruth.com. So I would direct you to go there after listening to this, or go there while you're listening to this program this evening. We broadcast every Saturday night live from Austin, Texas, between 7 and 9 p.m. Charlotte Littlefield Brown is off tonight. Anyway, we're going to be covering this D-Day. So getting back to the five sectors, there were five sectors: Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. Okay. And of those five sectors, you had different armies and so forth that were mobilized and organized to go into those different beaches. You had the American forces on Utah and Omaha. You had the British on Gold. You had the Canadians on Juneau. And then you had the British on Sword. So that's the way it was laid out on D-Day. But there was great planning and deception before this invasion was planned. In fact, President Eisenhower, who was the overall commander of the Allied forces, delayed the D-Day by 24 hours. The actual invasion was begun early on the 6th of June, 1944. And they had surmised and planned that they needed to get a tremendous number of people on the beach and supplies and vehicles and tanks and so forth within the first 5 days. The German high command was split about where the invasion would be. And also there was a great delay in Hitler giving the order to reallocate and relocate many of the troops that were anticipating the Calais and the, or the Sherborne, landings, and diverting those to, Normandy. The normal, German plan was to be able to remobilize those and move those troops down to the Normandy area within 2 weeks. But it took 7 weeks, for the Germans to actually receive the order. And by then we were well entrenched and well fortified on the beaches of Normandy, and we were moving east into France, ready to do battle with the Germans. And we were beginning to make a major beachhead after 5 days on the beaches of Normandy. The planning didn't always go right. The most bloody of all the beaches was Omaha. But there were snafus always in warfare. So it wasn't always, exactly, you know, planned that well sometimes. We had a deception that was developed. Almost most of the spies, the German spies that were tried to be infiltrated into the UK were captured shortly after entering the UK. And then they were turned, or their transmitters were used to send back to the Germans false information. There was what they call Operation Bodyguard. And it was a code name for a World War II deception. It was employed by the Allied states before the invasion of Normandy. And, it was intended to mislead the German high command to the time and place of the invasion. And it did work. The planning had been underway for Bodyguard in 1943, and under the auspices of the London Controlling Section. And they did a wonderful job in creating all kinds of false rabbit trails that led nowhere, see. And jail, Plan Jail was the name of the deception. And it was, of course, top secret all the time. But the masters of deception in this war were the British. The British mobilized, along with some of the finest American minds, they mobilized a tremendous, you could say, intellectual genius at overcoming the Germans during World War II. They had already broken some of their codes, German codes, and so we knew we were reading their mail, so to speak. And then we began to store, and we used false tanks. We used inflatable tanks. We parked those tanks in areas that would indicate that the invasion would be further north in Calais or Sherborne. And we did a lot of different misdeeds, to misdirection, I should say. And the Germans, they went for it. Thank goodness, because we did succeed in getting on within that first 5 days a tremendous number of troops. There was a Higgins landing craft that Higgins had devised, and it was a wonderful landing craft that could come in on very shallow water, fully loaded with troops, and deploy the men to where at least they could wade in from there. See, there were problems with this delay a little bit, but not much. When Eisenhower made the decision to delay the invasion of Normandy by 24 hours, there were certain tides and so forth that they had to account for. The movements of the moon were very important, because then that would dictate the tides and what time and hour that those tides would begin to rise and fall. So it was a dangerous undertaking in the sense that they had to get in on a certain date, you could say, where the tides would be, you know, low tides, and then they could have more beach and to get in on. Otherwise, the high tides, they wouldn't have the beaches that they would need to start unloading troops and equipment onto. So those were some of the factors, too. We also had the British devised a system, okay, of floating docks that they call mulberries. And this was an ingenious idea. The Americans, along with others, they seem to voice the opinion that the landing craft, they could do as well in landing gear and so forth with these large landing craft, where they would come in, drop the front, unload their deals, and then wait for high tide to refloat so they could pull back out. So that was sort of the deal on the landing craft. But what happened in the end was that the mulberries were floated in across the channel at the initial landings. And then they were set up to provide docking facilities. See, the Germans did not believe that we would invade and try to land on Normandy, because there were no big harbors and ports that we needed to start unloading the tons of equipment that we would need to go into Nazi-occupied France and Germany, of course, Germany then too. So they were, you know, oblivious to the fact that we had and were developing, and this is what the British mastered at, is that they put together what they call mulberries, okay? M-U-L-B-E-R-R-Y-S. And these mulberries proved to be a decisive, factor in going in there. These were temporary portable harbors, and they were developed by the United Kingdom during the Second World War, and they facilitated rapid unloading, offloading of cargo onto beaches during the Allied invasion of Normandy, which occurred on June 6th. Originally, it had been scheduled for June 5th, but it was rescheduled 24 hours. It was postponed, I should say, 24 hours to enable, the landing to be more successful. They had bad weather on the 5th of June, 1944. And so even with a delay and postponed 24 hours, the weather still was not ideal for what they tended to do. But they had to go at that point. The weather had lifted up, had eased up a little bit, and was not as bad on June 6th as it was June 5th. The story goes that many of our GIs, being on the boats for 3 or 4 days, and sometimes 5 days on some ships, became seasick. So some of the soldiers went in, they were having to step in or puke in those landing craft, and that could make some of them sick also. So they had a lot of things to overcome, and many of our people did get seasick before they hit the beaches. But that's just part of the warfare, I guess they say. Anyway, let's get back to these mulberry harbors. They were eventually developed around the Liverpool area away from the front so they wouldn't be bombed. There had to be a breakwater, and they would go in and sink ships out further out and to break the water a little bit and then start building the docks inside between there and the beaches. And then from the docks that they'd set up, these big caissons were sunk, and then they would run pontoon bridges, which would support many of the tanks and many of the trucks or so forth that could go on top of these pontoon bridges. So that was actually what they did. They had trials of these and used all kinds of methods. It took some great engineering skills that the British had to eventually build these portable floating docks. Now, in the end, not only did the big landing craft unload a lot of equipment, but these mulberries did too. So I guess the credit would go to about 50-50. In other words, about 50% of the success of the landing of the equipment could be attributed to the mulberries, and about half of the other could be allocated and attributed to these gigantic landing craft, see. So both were necessary, and both were very helpful to get onto the shore, okay. Now, if you go back into thesecrettruth.com, and scroll down there right below, right above the June 8th, D-Day special program, I have a couple of click-offs, a Memorial Weekend tribute. And I leave this up all year round. But there are three click-offs there. There's an Overseas Memorial Cemetery click-off, and there's a poem by a good friend of mine, Opie Houston. Let me read that poem for you. Around the poem, I have all the international cemeteries where American soldiers have been buried. Okay, let me read this poem. It's entitled Veteran. Here we go. The crowd drowns out the wheelchair's groan as with left arm he pushes himself upward onto all but useless legs. Then as the flag passes, his back straightens and the arm braces smartly against his side while the memory of the right arm snaps an invisible salute. That's written by Opie R. Houston, and he's a Air Force vet himself. But anyway, around that poem, I put click-offs to all the international overseas cemeteries. And if you click on any of those cemeteries there, you know, you'll go to the actual federal site, which tells all about those. Then also in there, I have a beautiful song, and it's a song that is done by the One Voice Children's Choir out of Salt Lake City, and it's When You Believe. And so go in there and listen to that. And they are actually, they filmed the singing of that song on Omaha Beach. Okay? So, that's something, a very poignant and very, very beautiful song that, I put up on this particular site. Anyway, at the last, 27 minutes and 8 or 9 seconds, of this program, you're going to be listening to President Trump's speech that he gave at the memorial ceremony there on Omaha Beach. And the history, I do have other click off further down on this site, thesecrettruth.com. I have a reporter that has a YouTube, video up. And that's very interesting. Tells about the landing crafts and so forth. And also, on Star Trek, James Doohan was a Canadian lieutenant in World War II. And he was a hero. He went in on D-Day, and he guided his crew, his company through some very mined areas of safety, and then he took out some machine gun nests and so forth. But anyway, James Doohan was quite a hero there, and you'll get that click off too. I think Daily newspaper has some stuff up on him. So go in there and read that too, and look at that. And there were a lot of heroes out there. They were talking during this series of D-Day ceremonies and memorials to quite a plethora of individuals and veterans that were still survivors of the D-Day. And they were talking to one gentleman that all he did was collect up bodies and bury people. I mean, you know, just take care of the dead, you know. And then set later on, they would begin to set up these gigantic cemeteries all along the coast there. World War One, there were gigantic cemeteries there in France in different locations, and of many of the thousands that died in World War One of our troops. And then we added to that other cemeteries, and other people were buried, other soldiers were buried there as casualties of this invasion. And the initial going into France, there was a lot of resistance, and so there were a lot of soldiers that died, you know, on the way into Germany in France, and so many of those were buried in those cemeteries. And of course, they brought a lot of the dead back even after they got into Germany and so forth. But the war would be tough, and it would go on all summer, and eventually we would win. And the Russians were coming in from the east side, and they were coming into Berlin and so forth. And I believe Eisenhower allowed them to come into Berlin first. I had been over there in Berlin doing some intelligence work, and so I saw some of the remnants and so forth of World War II. The Reichstag at the time was in ruins, and it was just inside of the Berlin Wall in East Berlin. So we couldn't actually go there, but they left it in ruins because of Nazi Germany. And then after World War II, they rebuilt it and restored it, and they call it the Bundestag now. And it's it added visitors, a patio up on top, I think, where you can go up there and look down from there to the city. I think our embassy is somewhere close by. But getting back to the, you could say D-Day here, is that there were many people that sacrificed their husbands and their loved ones to make this work out. The Normandy landings were codenamed actually Operation Neptune. And like I said, it was June 6, 1944. And the operation had been planned since 1943 to go in there to Normandy. But it was a closely held secret. There were cliffs along Omaha Beach where the Germans could have a good line of fire. And so that's what made Omaha Beach very treacherous. And the bombers that were supposed to bomb out and take out some of those fortifications on the up above the cliffs dropped their bombs further out into the ocean and didn't take out those. So the guys, our American going in on Omaha, they experienced a very, very tough go. So we've got to remember this and not forget it, because there were American soldiers there and the British and the Canadians on those five beaches that lost a lot of their loved ones and their husbands and so forth. And we just have to continue to uphold this and not let it slip away from us. There's so much today that they're not teaching. And our school system is not being taught what they should in many cases. And as a result, we just, you know, have just very, very, very ignorant people about World War II, much less, you know, the Civil War. They don't know the American Revolution. They don't even know what's going on out there, some of our young people. And if you ask them, hey, who did we fight during the American Revolution, they might tell you it was Poland, something like that. You know, I've seen stuff on YouTube where people have actually answered, the question with that kind of answer. And that shows you how ignorant everything has become. I mean, these young people. So we're trying to, the great insiders, the deep state, the internationalists, the globalists are trying to integrate America into this one world government, see. So in doing that, they want to actually leave behind our history, and the best part of America is actually being left behind. And that's what's so frustrating and sad about what's happening in this country today, is that we've got just a bunch of school systems that want to teach all kinds of perversions and so forth and ignore the great things and our founding fathers brought to this country. Much less, they're not teaching like natural law. You're not going to find natural law being taught in our schools. And what is natural law? Natural law is based upon the idea that the world itself is God created, see? And it's not created by men. So there are natural laws out there that we have to be wary of and respectful of. And if we ignore those natural laws, then we're gonna suffer as a result of ignoring some of these natural laws. And so this is what we've got to put up with today, is that we've got an abstraction of creation, of government, and all kinds of different ideas, sociological ideas, theory, one theory after another. And all these theories have been, you could say, created and laid one on top of another to where there's a matrix that you can't see through. All you're dealing with in many cases is just people spewing forth a bunch of abstractions and ideas and theories and concepts about reality. Now, I maintain that because we're hateful to one another or resentful and so forth, then that continues the false state, which continues the delusion. And that's what I mean by the delusion. I mean that we're from infancy, we're cultivated and nurtured into a deluded state. And what I mean by that is that we have a less than accurate view of reality and our place in that reality. And as a result, then we begin to conceptualize the world in a way that is not accurately, you could say, perceived. And that then that perception, because it is inaccurate, that perception can be manipulated and used to control us. And that's actually what's going on, is that we're continually being bombarded by ideas that are used to control us. But the ideas used to control us are preying upon us because of our delusion, see. If we were more knowledgeable and more objective and less subjective, We're being seduced into a subjective state through these abstractions of ideas. That's what's going on. So if we can somehow forgive ourselves and others and try to attain a greater objectivity about ourselves and the world, then we can begin to awaken to a more accurate view of reality. But also, it enables us to begin to see ourselves, and we can come out of this, you could say, this state of delusion, or you could say this state of denying ability with denying denial. You know what I mean? There's a state of denial that is operative, and we're denying the truth about ourselves to ourselves, somehow thinking that that is protecting and defending ourselves, when in essence, when we deny the truth about ourselves to ourselves, we're furthering and continuing to nurture that false self, which is the gatekeeper. So we have to awaken in some way. And the only way that I've been able to perceive this process as being worthwhile is one where you can begin to forgive yourself and others. And what that does is that begins to slowly dissolve that false self. And then you can affect a return to the core real self, which is conscience-based. So in addition to the state of consciousness, I created a new state that I call the state of consciousness. And the state of consciousness is a state of spirituality, of enlightenment. But we have been seduced by all kinds of different leaders of this and leaders of that. All kinds of cultic types of organizations are always spewing forth what they believe the truth should be. So the group that they want you to join is actually, in opposition to and is hateful and resentful to all other outside groups. So we're continually undergoing an indoctrination by one group or another that we have joined into. So I'm okay and they're not okay. That's sort of the hustle that we begin to see. And this hustle can only get worse and worse as time goes on. And unless we can become objective. And you become objective is when you begin to practice forgiveness of self and others. And then you can begin to dissolve the false self. And it has a lessening, as you continue this process, it'll have a lessening influence, and a greater influence will be the core self, which is conscience based, which is the spiritual self. So when you begin to do this, you're walking down the street and you become a reborn person, because you're really reborn into a state of being. You could say a state of forgiveness being, where you can reflect that to others. So you can change the world by changing yourself. So don't worry about what other people are doing. Start, when you point fingers, two are pointing at whoever you're pointing at, but three fingers are pointing back. Meaning that we must address our problems that we have internally in our minds and hearts and souls. We must awaken to the fact that it is up to us to be proactive and proactively overcome that thought prison. So we have the keys to unlock that prison cell, but it resides in our heart, in our soul, in our mind. And if we continue to hate and resent, those keys are forever gone from us. But the minute those resentments and hatreds are let go of, then those keys fall and reappear in our hands. And then we can turn that lock and walk out of that prison cell, that thought prison, that mind control, mind prison. See, that's what it is. We're continually bombarded by thoughts that do nothing to free us, but do all to enslave us. And these great sorcerers, mind sorcery, is practiced on us through this mind wash and mind control system. So they just continue to rile us up and continue for us to hate the other side, see? And that's what we must try to resist is that we must try to resist hating the opposition. But we cannot, if the opposition is truly evil, we have to continue to struggle against that evil. But you can struggle against it and not hate it, knowing that that good will overcome evil eventually. So you have to practice on the good side, and then you can come out of that hate filled, you know, and then only hate promulgates additional hatred, and it is the end to a world of peace and serenity. So when you begin to forgive yourself and others, you enter in and you begin to establish a peace and serenity that will release you from this control of others. And all you're doing there is you have that other person in your mind that you hate and resent, and thus they have you, see, under their control, because that they are in you. And if it was a person that really promulgated a lot of upsetfulness in you, then that upsetfulness is part of you. So you must extract yourself and let go of that, and then will arise a new way of living, a new way of being, one that is not hateful, not resentful, non-judgmental, that has true love for thy neighbor and for humanity and humankind. Now coming up is President Trump.
President Macron, Mrs. Macron, and the people of France, to the First Lady of the United States, and members of the United States Congress, to distinguished guests, veterans, and my fellow Americans, we are gathered here on freedom's altar. On these shores, on these bluffs, on this day, 75 years ago, 10,000 men shed their blood and thousands sacrificed their lives for their brothers, for their countries, and for the survival of liberty. Today we remember those who fell, and we honor all who fought right here in Normandy. They won back this ground for civilization to more than 170 veterans of the Second World War who join us today. You are among the very greatest Americans who will ever live. You are the pride of our nation. You are the glory of our republic. And we thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Here with you are over 60 veterans who landed on D-Day. Our debt to you is everlasting. Today we express our undying gratitude. When you were young, these men enlisted their lives in a great crusade, one of the greatest of all times. Their mission is the story of an epic battle and the ferocious, eternal struggle between good and evil. On the 6th of June, 1944, they joined a liberation force of awesome power and breathtaking scale. After months of planning, the Allies had chosen this ancient coastline to mount their campaign to vanquish the wicked tyranny of the Nazi Empire from the face of the earth. The battle began in the skies above us. In those first tense midnight hours, 1,000 aircraft roared overhead with 17,000 Allied airborne troops preparing to leap into the darkness beyond these trees. Then came dawn. The enemy who had occupied these heights saw the largest naval armada in the history of the world. Just a few miles offshore were 7,000 vessels bearing 130,000 warriors. They were the citizens of free and independent nations united by their duty to their compatriots and to millions yet unborn. There were the British whose nobility and fortitude saw them through the worst of Dunkirk and the London Blitz. The full violence of Nazi fury was no match for the full grandeur of British pride. Thank you. There were the Canadians, whose robust sense of honor and loyalty compelled them to take up arms alongside Britain from the very, very beginning. There were the fighting Poles, the tough Norwegians, and the intrepid Aussies. There were the gallant French commandos, soon to be met by thousands of their brave countrymen ready to write a new chapter in the long history of French valor. And finally, there were the Americans. They came from the farms of a vast heartland, the streets of glowing cities, and the forges of mighty industrial towns. Before the war, many had never ventured beyond their own community. Now they had come to offer their lives half a world from home. This beach, codenamed Omaha, was defended by the Nazis with monstrous firepower, thousands and thousands of mines and spikes driven into the sand so deeply. It was here that tens of thousands of the Americans came, the GIs who boarded the landing craft that morning knew that they carried on their shoulders not just the pack of a soldier, but the fate of the world. Colonel George Taylor, whose 16th Infantry Regiment would join in the first wave, was asked what would happen if the Germans stopped. Right then and there, cold on the beach, just stopped them. What would happen? This great American replied, "Why, the 18th Infantry is coming in right behind us. The 26th Infantry will come on too. Then there is the 2nd Infantry Division, already afloat, and the 9th Division, and the 2nd Armored, and the 3rd Armored, and all the rest. Maybe the 16th won't make it, but someone will." One of those men in Taylor's 16th Regiment was Army Medic Ray Lambert. Ray was only 23, but he had already earned 3 Purple Hearts and 2 Silver Stars fighting in North Africa and Sicily, where he and his brother Bill, no longer with us, served side by side. In the early morning hours, the two brothers stood together on the deck of the USS Henrico before boarding 2 separate Higgins landing craft. "If I don't make it," Bill said, "please, please, take care of my family. Ray asked his brother to do the same. Of the 31 men on Ray's landing craft, only Ray and six others made it to the beach. There were only a few of them left. They came to the sector right here below us. Easy Red, it was called. Again and again, Ray ran back into the water. He dragged out one man after another. He was shot through the arm. His leg was ripped open by shrapnel. His back was broken. He nearly drowned. He had been on the beach for hours, bleeding and saving lives, when he finally lost consciousness. He woke up the next day on a cot beside another badly wounded soldier. He looked over and saw his brother Bill. They made it. They made it. They made it. At 98 years old, Ray is here with us today with his fourth Purple Heart and his third Silver Star from Omaha. Ray, the free world salutes you. Nearly 2 hours in, unrelenting fire from these bluffs kept the Americans pinned down on the sand, now red with our hero's blood. Then, just a few hundred yards from where I'm standing, a breakthrough came. The battle turned, and with it, history. Down on the beach, Captain Joe Dawson, the son of a Texas preacher, led Company G through a minefield to a natural fold in the hillside, still here. Just beyond this path, to my right, Captain Dawson snuck beneath an enemy machine gun perch and tossed his grenades. Soon American troops were charging up Dawson's draw. What a job he did. What bravery he showed. Lieutenant Spaulding and the men from Company E moved on to crush the enemy strong point on the far side of this cemetery and stop the slaughter on the beach below. Countless more Americans poured out across this ground all over the countryside. They joined fellow American warriors from Utah Beach and allies from Juneau, Sword and Gold, along with the Airborne and the French Patriots. Private First Class Russell Pickett of the 29th Division's famed 116th Infantry Regiment had been wounded in the first wave that landed on Omaha Beach. At a hospital in England, Private Pickett vowed to return to battle. "I'm going to return," he said. "I'm going to return." 6 days after D-Day, he rejoined his company, 2/3 had been killed already. Many had been wounded within 15 minutes of the invasion. They lost 19 just from the small town of Bedford, Virginia alone. Before long, a grenade left Private Pickett, and he was gravely wounded, so badly wounded. Again, he chose to return. He didn't care. He had to be here. He was then wounded a third time and laid unconscious for 12 days. They thought he was gone. They thought he had no chance. Russell Pickett is the last known survivor of the legendary Company A. And today, believe it or not, he has returned once more to these shores to be with his comrades. Private Pickett, you honor us all with your presence. Tough guy. By the fourth week of August, Paris was liberated. Some who landed here pushed all the way to the center of Germany. Some threw open the gates of Nazi concentration camps to liberate Jews who had suffered the bottomless horrors of the Holocaust. And some warriors fell on other fields of battle, returning to rest on this soil for eternity. Before this place was consecrated to history, the land was owned by a French farmer, a member of the French resistance. These were great people. These were strong and tough people. His terrified wife waited out D-Day in a nearby house, holding tight to their little baby girl. The next day, a soldier appeared. "I'm an American," he said. "I'm here to help." The French woman was overcome with emotion and cried. Days later, she laid flowers on fresh American graves. Today, her granddaughter, Stephanie, serves as a guide at this cemetery. This week, Stephanie led 92-year-old Marion Nguyen of California to see the grave of her brother Don for the very first time. Marion and Stephanie are both with us today, and we thank you for keeping alive the memories of our precious heroes. Thank you. Nine 388 young Americans rest beneath the White Crosses, and Stars of David arrayed on these beautiful grounds. Each one has been adopted by a French family that thinks of him as their own. They come from all over France to look after our boys. They kneel, they cry, they pray, they place flowers, and they never forget. Today, America embraces the French people and thanks you for honoring our beloved dead. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. To all of our friends and partners, our cherished alliance was forged in the heat of battle, tested in the trials of war, and proven in the blessings of peace. Our bond is unbreakable. From across the earth, Americans are drawn to this place as though it were a part of our very soul. We come not only because of what they did here. We come because of who they were. They were young men with their entire lives before them. They were husbands who said goodbye to their young brides and took their duty as their fate. They were fathers who would never meet their infant sons and daughters because they had a job to do. And with God as their witness, they were going to get it done. They came wave after wave without question, without hesitation, and without complaint. More powerful than the strength of American arms was the strength of American hearts. These men ran through the fires of hell, moved by a force no weapon could destroy. The fierce patriotism of a free, proud, and sovereign people. They battled not for control and domination, but for liberty, democracy, and self-rule. They pressed on for love and home and country, the main streets, the schoolyards, the churches, and neighbors, the families, and communities that gave us men such as these. They were sustained by the confidence that America can do anything. Because we are a noble nation with a virtuous people praying to a righteous God. The exceptional might came from a truly exceptional spirit. The abundance of courage came from an abundance of faith. The great deeds of an army came from the great depths of their love. As they confronted their fate, the Americans of the Allies placed themselves into the palm of God's hand. The men behind me will tell you that they are just the lucky ones. As one of them recently put it, all the heroes are buried here. But we know what these men did. We knew how brave they were. They came here and saved freedom. And then they went home and showed us all what freedom is all about. The American sons and daughters who saw us to victory were no less extraordinary in peace. They built families. They built industries. They built a national culture that inspired the entire world. In the decades that followed, America defeated communism, secured civil rights, revolutionized science, launched a man to the moon, and then kept on pushing to new frontiers. And today, America is stronger than ever before. Seven decades ago, the warriors of D-Day fought a sinister enemy who spoke of a thousand-year empire. In defeating that evil, they left a legacy that will last not only for a thousand years, but for all time. For as long as the soul knows of duty and honor, for as long as freedom keeps its hold on the human heart. To the men who sit behind me and to the boys who rest in the field before me, your example will never, ever grow old. Your legend will never die. Your spirit, brave, unyielding, and true, will never die. The blood that they spilled, the tears that they shed, the lives that they gave, the sacrifice that they made, did not just win a battle. It did not just win a war. Those who fought here won a future for our nation. They won the survival of our civilization. And they showed us the way to love, cherish, and defend our way of life for many centuries to come. Today, as we stand together upon this sacred earth, we pledge that our nation will forever be strong and united. We will forever be together. Our people will forever be bold. Our hearts will forever be loyal. And our children and their children will forever and always be free. May God bless our great veterans. May God bless our allies. May God bless the heroes of D-Day. And may God bless America. Thank you. Thank you very much.